You're recording.
All right, we're back in open session. We are back on section three, the informal interviews. This is the time and place scheduled for the informal interview of Monica Durgan, DVM, in case number 2233. This matter will be heard by the board pursuant to the authority given it in ARS 322234. Dr. Durgan, please come forward and introduce yourself and your attorney if represented by counsel.
I'm Dr. Monica Durgan.
And David Soule appearing as legal counsel for Dr. Durgan.
Thank you. Dr. Durgan, you've received a letter informing you of the matters to be discussed today and the possible actions the board may take at this informal interview. As a reminder, those options include dismissal, issuing you a non-disciplinary letter of concern, censuring you, and placing your license on probation, with terms that may include continuing education and practice restrictions. The board may also suspend your license for up to 30 days, assess a civil penalty, or refer this matter to a formal hearing. The purpose of this informal interview is to inquire into the facts and circumstances of this case. The board has read all the materials you submitted. If you have any additional materials you would like to present to the board, please do so now.
We have no additional material.
Thank you. This proceeding is being digitally recorded. As a result, it is important that everyone speak loudly and clearly, and that only one person speaks at a time. We'll begin by asking the lead board member assigned this matter to give a brief summary of the case, and then you will be given an opportunity to respond. Following your response, the board needs to ask you some questions. At present, the complainant will also be given an opportunity to address the board. If you have any questions for the board or anyone giving you information during this interview, you may ask them through me. And Dr. Nosley, would you please give us a brief summary of the case?
Okay. On August 17th, 2021, Enzo, an approximately 1.5-year-old male French bulldog, was presented to the respondent for a neuter procedure. During the exam, the respondent noted that the dog had stenotic nares and offered to widen the nares while the dog was under anesthesia for the neuter procedure, and the pet owner agreed. Later that afternoon, the staff sedated the dog with TT Dex and monitored him until he was ready to be intubated. While being intubated, the staff noted the dog became cyanotic and a pulse could not be found. The respondent was alerted and CPR efforts were initiated. The pet owner was contacted and instructed to come to the premises as the dog had arrested. When the pet owner arrived, she was informed that the dog had passed away.
So Dr. Durgan, at this time I'd like to swear you in. You solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. Thank you. We'd now like to give you the opportunity to respond to the summary and present whatever information you believe is relevant.
Thank you. As you know, this was a routine neuter procedure, and I want you to know that the fact that Enzo was a brachycephalic breed, a French bulldog specifically, was not lost on me. I've been in practice over 32 years and have performed hundreds of anesthetic procedures on brachycephalic dogs without complications. I know now, and I knew when I sedated Enzo, that brachycephalic breeds are prone to respiratory complications, and despite the fact that I administered an appropriate anesthetic medication within the range of appropriate dosages, we had a tragic complication. When Enzo presented on the morning of August 17, 2021, I performed a preoperative examination at 7:15 and noticed that he had those stenotic nares. That is why I offered to widen the nares as long as Enzo was under anesthesia. Again, this is something that I have done with brachycephalic patients on prior occasions without complications. A pre-op exam was done, but unfortunately it took a little over 6 hours for us to begin that anesthetic procedure. The focus of your inquiry appears to be the TT Dex dose. In that regard, I administered a dose of 0.21 mLs or 0.0216 milliliters per kilogram to Enzo. If you look at the reference materials submitted in this case, including the peer-reviewed publication, analgesia, sedation, and anesthesia, as well as the guidelines published for dextromethorphan, the dose I administered was within the range of acceptable dosages and was not excessive. Specifically, the dose I administered was between the 0.02 milliliters per kilogram, which is deemed profound sedation, and the 0.035 milliliters per kilogram, which is considered an appropriate surgical anesthesia level. Since the dosage amount was appropriate, I respectfully disagree with the suggestion that I was grossly negligent in connection with the dextromethorphan dose in this case. With regard to the pre-surgery monitoring, Enzo was continuously and appropriately monitored and observed by both me and my staff right up until the time he was intubated. Specifically, as I noted in my narrative response, after Enzo was checked in and examined by me at approximately 7:25 a.m., he was placed in a kennel that overlooks the surgery area. That kennel was visible from all three surgical tables, and there was never a time between 7:15 and 1:55 p.m. when Enzo was administered the dextromethorphan when he was not in open and plain view of my staff, who are trained to continuously monitor all kennel patients throughout the day. Ahead of today's hearing, you've been provided premise pictures so that you can see how visible Enzo was and how he was monitored prior to surgery. In those pictures, you will see that there are a few larger kennels. This is where Enzo was placed and where, as a special protocol, we assign the brachycephalic patients. This was a policy that was in place at the time so that those patients are placed in the more easily monitored kennels in the surgery area. Those that have stenotic nares have kennel assignments in those larger kennels closer to the surgery tables as seen in the pictures of the premise. In closing, I stand behind the veterinary care I provided in this case, but I'm deeply saddened by the unfortunate outcome. Again, I extend my sympathies to the owner. There is nothing that I can do or say that will abate the loss of a dearly loved pet. At the end of the day, I believe this is one of those cases where a veterinarian can do everything right and administer anesthetic medications within the range of acceptable dosages and have an unfortunate and tragic outcome. I am now available to answer any additional questions you may have.
Thank you. I'd now like to ask the board members if they have questions for Dr. Durgan.
Yes. Hello again, Dr. Durgan. A few questions. At that intake exam, when you had a discussion with the owner about the stenotic nares, your record indicates that the oral nasal throat was not evaluated. Can you explain that?
I believe in my mind, and at that time, I could have sworn that I had put those records into the electronic medical record keeping system. I cannot explain why they are not there. I know that my staff's information is there. I don't know if we had a malfunction that day with our Wi-Fi. I wish I could explain that for you.
Okay, thank you. The record indicates that that information was to be provided to the owner concerning soft palate resection due to the stridor he had. Can you explain what you mean by that statement, the stridor he had?
He had stridor on the exam. He was, it's a deep sound when they breathe.
Okay. And so, and you would correlate that then with the possibility of soft palate?
Correct.
Okay. And you also added that information was to be sent to the owner about the brachycephalic syndrome. So why would you send that information to them?
I send that to all of the brachycephalic airway patient owners so that they're aware that even though they may get the stenotic nares surgery, It doesn't prevent them from necessarily getting the elongated soft palate as a secondary sign later. And there are other complications too that go along with that brachycephalic airway syndrome. If we note that they have an elongated soft palate at the time that we're intubating them, we actually send them a list of surgeons that do that soft palate resection, since I do not do that surgery.
So if I understood correctly, you direct how to calculate the dose of the TT dex.
That is correct.
And then the staff then
draws
it up, weighs the animal, draws it up, and administers it.
That is correct.
Is the dose standard for all patients by weight and not individualized for a particular patient? Breed, weight, age, sex, pre-existing conditions, whatever.
I do change that for various animals and conditions. We have noted with our formula-fed kittens that they do not do well with either the Telazol straight or the TT Dex, and so we do adjust those dosages. There are other animals on exam that don't seem to do as well, and so we may even change to propofol.
How about specifically for brachiocephalics?
At the time that I saw Enzo, he was going to be the 38th brachiocephalic getting a stenotic nares for the 2021 records at that time, that year. And they all had undergone the TT Dex, and after Enzo, my staff and I actually had a lot of difficulty dealing with that, and so we have since changed our protocol for all brachycephalics, not just the stenotic nares.
Okay. Is the dose of the TT Dex intended to provide for sedation for intubation or to provide for a surgical level of anesthesia? Intubation and then gas? Or
yes,
is it
yes.
Or is it to take them all the way to a surgical plane?
No, it is not. It's for sedation so that they may be intubated and placed on isoflurane.
And did you say that the dose was between profound and surgical?
That is correct. It is just barely above the profound sedation.
Okay. And then regarding the monitoring of the patients after they receive their dose of pre-medication, do you remember how many other patients were under the effects of their pre-meds at the same time as Enzo? Typically, or that
right.
day, or
typically what the staff does is have one patient on isoflurane, and I said one patient per table, and then one patient that's getting their dosage when a patient is coming off the table. So there would be four patients typically that need closer monitoring.
And how many assistants would be in the room at that time?
There are six, not counting me.
Not counting you. Six, okay. At this time, when this happened, were you in surgery during the time Enzo was under the effects of the TT Dex and in his?
That is correct. He was going to be my next patient.
Okay. So is there a protocol in place for monitoring these patients that we're talking about that includes more than just visual?
A lot of the brachycephalics, some of them have noises that they make while they're awake, and if they stop making those noises, that cues us to look at them once they have their sedation. So
noises when they're under the TT?
When they're awake.
When they're awake.
When
okay.
they're awake.
Okay.
Okay. So if they're noisy before sedation and they get quiet, we know we need to take a look at them right away. If they are quiet before sedation, we need to be right there.
Okay. with, do you remember in Enzo's case, did the staff tell you anything about?
He was an open mouth noisy breather.
Through the whole pre-med?
Through the whole pre-med.
Okay. So I think you explained about the protocols in your hospital that are followed for brachiocephalic breathes. I had that question, but I think you covered that. So I don't have any other questions.
Couple on my side. Do you typically pre-oxygenate your brachiocephalics?
We do not.
And then how many hours prior to surgery would you say you had completed the exam?
It was a little over 6 hours.
So, like, came in the morning, did the exam, talked to them, and then 6 hours later started?
Okay. Correct.
I don't have any additional questions.
Any other board members have questions? Seeing none, you may step back.
Thank you.
We'll now hear from the complainant. Would you please come forward and introduce yourself?
Good afternoon. My name is Joseph Brecken.
Thank you. Do you solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Thank you. And you are the complainant in this case, correct?
That is correct.
Right. We've read all the materials you provided, and you may address the board.
Thank you. First of all, thank you again for, now the third time, the opportunity to address the board. I'm not a vet, so I'm looking towards this board and your expertise to hopefully make the right decision in this. I do firmly believe that Enzo died due to gross negligence under the care of Dr. Durgin. Several mistakes are present in the medical report. These mistakes include inconsistencies in the doctor's statements, record documentation errors, lack of a thorough pre-surgical physical exam, inappropriate anesthetic protocol for the breathe, lack of proper medical documentation, and the lack of appropriate staff monitoring and support. In an email I received from Dr. Durgin on August 30th, 2021, she said the only abnormality with Enzo was his stenotic nares. But this was not documented in the record, and the respiratory system was evaluated as normal. That's what's in the record. Dr. Durgin's statement in her email showed Enzo had stenotic nares. This is a combination of being a brachiocephalic, if I pronounce it correct, breed is enough to document BOAS and necessitate a specialized anesthetic plan for that type of patient, which was not. In an article, breed-specific anesthesia, quotes from the article are genetic differences and anatomic factors can contribute to the variability of complication during anesthetic events. Safe and successful sedation and anesthesia can be performed in any breed of dog and cat with proper preoperative workup and appropriate patient monitoring. Regarding brachiocephalic dogs, and I can't pronounce the actual anesthesia or whatever it's called, dexamethasone should be avoided because of the presence of the high vagal tone in these breeds. Here's my challenge here. A dose of 0.21 milliliters was given. Based on the charts, for a 21-pound dog, the dosage of 0.21 exceeded the profound dosage of 0.15 milliliters. Furthermore, it was noted to not use a dose of more than 0.02 milligrams per kilogram for high-risk patients, which is exactly what Enzo was, which she acknowledges. A high dose would be defined and calculated as 0.19. She used 0.21. High dose is also noted to cause respiratory depression, the exact result in Enzo with his death and overdose. A thorough physical examination was not performed as the following body systems were entered as not evaluated. There is really no discussion needed on that. That's against the proper procedures and practices. She didn't even perform an exam before all of this. But further exemplifies the gross negligence. This leads to the most egregious area of concern in Enzo's situation, which is the lack of proper monitoring and medical support staff. You know, the Wire article states that anesthetic for dogs suffering from BOS should be managed with minimal sedative premedication, pre-oxygenization, which was not done, and rapid intubation following induction. Brachylephatic breed are particularly prone to airway obstruction, which she noted, during the pre-anesthetic period. They are prone to obstruct and die if left unattended after being given sedatives or other anesthetic drugs. Exactly what happened to Enzo. Enzo was left in the cage without constant observation and shown by the quote of the record. We pulled Enzo out of the kennel, quote, laying on his side. Based on the times entered, he was unattended in the cage for 13 minutes. He was then taken from the cage and intubation was attempted. We do not have the documented time for how long the individual's technicians struggled to intubate the high-risk patient by themselves. The reason we have no idea how long it took is from that point on, all the record on the times are suspect due to the fact that they are all documented as happening prior to the intubation, which is impossible, correct? During the time that the technician was struggling to intubate Enzo, he went from breathing, per the statement in the chart, to having abnormal color and found to be in cardiac arrest. It was only at that time help was sought during the time the technician was having intubating him, that a second technician was called over to decide if he was arresting. Only after both technicians checked him was the doctor then notified. As noted in the O'Dwyer article, when intubating a brachylophatic patient, expect to use a much smaller tube than typically used for similar sized patients. Carefully select the wide variety and be ready with two tubes smaller to estimate the larger size, etc., etc. The tube size on the chart was entered as zero, even though it shows later in there that he finally got in a size six. Discoordinate timelines entered into the induction injection is later by 14 minutes than the times recorded for the CPR efforts. It was a complete mess, everything. As it pertains to the lack, I was asked during the first meeting, why didn't we order a necroscopy or the opportunity to request one? Dr. Durgin cremated Enzo without my authority or approval or written consent. And when I requested it, I received an email back saying if you would have asked for that 3 days earlier, we could have done it, but we've already cremated him. She also stated in that email, in the past, I have sent a couple of other animals in for necroscopy and no issues were found with drug dose. In conclusion, multiple serious errors were evident causing the death of Enzo, both medically and with record keeping that should be actionable by this Arizona Veterinary Medical Board. It is also disturbing that Dr. Jurgen would not be willing or recognize these issues per her quote in the same email. There is nothing I would have changed about the induction, whether it was drugs used or the amounts of those drugs or the staff I had assisting me. This concern confirms for me total disregard to the established principles and practices ASRS 32-22-32-11. My plea to this board is to please have her recognize the mistakes and held accountable for the mistakes of the death of my pet and my dog, if we have any attempt of hoping for this not repeating itself. Thank you.
I'd like to ask board members, do you have any questions for the complainant in this case? I've got one. In the respondent's narrative, we have in here the owner was called and she was asked to come down. You're obviously not a she. She came with a young man.
I don't identify as one, no.
Okay.
Sorry.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
My lovely girlfriend in the back of the room was the one who actually was called, and okay, she went because I was out of town.
So it says she was also offered a necropsy, which was declined, as noted in the medical record.
That's not true. And we can call her up and ask if you'd like. Nor is there any documentation to show that I approved cremation or she approved cremation. There's nothing. Just like the medical records, it's a mess. We had no opportunity of any sort to do anything. So I had to then go over and actually find, which I have a written and signed statement from another, which I'm more than happy to give to the board. You received a summary, which I, Dr. Carolyn DeRager, DVM, CDABM, to whom it may concern, I am in the professional agreement with the summary outlining several areas of negligence that led to the death of Enzo. This summary was based on a thorough review of Enzo's medical records of the event and relevant medical literature. Please contact me if you have any questions regarding the evaluation of this case. I went out on my own and had it done because, not to sound horrible about my Enzo, the evidence was gone. I had nothing besides what I have, which is the medical records and what they put in the report. So I had to go on Google and Google how much dosage it was supposed to be, which is grossly overdosage, especially for the breed. Why would you go and profoundly sedate a brachylophatic dog into the surgical anesthesia level and then leave him unattended and nobody actually watches him and not pre-oxygenate him? You know damn well he's gonna die. And that's exactly what happened.
Any other board members have questions for the complainant? Seeing none, you may step back.
Thank you.
Dr. Durgan, do you or your legal counsel have any additional remarks or questions you'd like to ask?
I have some closing remarks that I think Doctor wants to address the necropsy issue. With regard to the examination that was done, at 7:15 a.m., Dr. Durgan did an examination that's in the medical records. Enzo's TPR are recorded and the results of her physical examination are also in the record. By doctor's own admission, some of those physical exam findings that were done and performed didn't make it into the medical records. But among her findings was that Enzo had stenotic nares, and she offered to widen them during the neuter procedure. The complaint just said that there's nothing in the medical record to reflect that. But if you look at the surgical consent form that was signed, the procedures that were to be performed included a neuter, and then there's the initials SN in there, and that's what that SN stands for, that procedure. So it was noted by the doctor, and the owner consented to them being corrected. So Dr. Durgan clearly appreciated the fact that Enzo was a brachiocephalic breed and needed that procedure performed as well. With regard to the alleged violation of R311-502H3, failure to perform an exam within 6 hours, this is not a situation where an exam was not done. Dr. Durgan did perform an exam. It was a little over 6 hours prior to anesthesia. So while there may not have been an exam technically within the 6 hours, there was substantial compliance with that regulation, which is in place to make sure that a pet is examined prior to an exam. So at most, that would be a letter of concern. Also, the evidence presented supports that the investigative committee was mistaken in their finding that Dr. Durgan administered inappropriate dosage of dextromidor. Her dose of 0.21 was within the range of acceptable dosages, and we submitted a lot of peer review articles that support that. Those materials support that she used a level of profound sedation, which is what she was doing. She was sedating the dog for the procedure. She did not use any anesthesia or a dosage that exceeded the recommended dosages, and there is not enough evidence to support that she did anything in connection with anesthesia that fell below the standard of care. Finally, it's important for you to note that the doctor did have special protocols in place at the practice for the care and treatment of brachiocephalic breeds. As set forth in the pictures that we've submitted, she had designated kennels and designated areas for brachiocephalic breeds so that they were more visible to her and to staff. And you heard the doctor say that in addition to herself, there were six other staff members that were constantly monitoring this pet after that medication was administered. So that policy is in place and was followed, and we do not believe that there's sufficient evidence to find any type of violation for lack of monitoring. Finally, with regard to the necropsy, it's in the medical record. The complainant was out of town. It was his girlfriend that was present. A necropsy was offered. We would have welcomed a necropsy. They're always welcome. As much information as we can get, the better. But it was expressly declined. So I just want to dispel this notion that doctor somehow destroyed evidence. We couldn't do a necropsy without the owner's consent, and the owner's agent was present and expressly declined it as noted in the record. Is there anything else you wish to add?
Yes, I know that Mr. Brecken is very taken aback about that I wouldn't have changed anything. How often do veterinarians have a full staff? I didn't need to fill a position in my hospital that day. I had had full staff for over 6 months at that point in time. I had no one on vacation, and I had no one at lunch. And one of those people that was helping me do CPR is actually an Army medic that does CPR with me when it needs to be done because of his training in Afghanistan. And I have no one other than him helping me with those chest compressions. So it is very unfortunate that we did what we could to bring Enzo back, and I cannot bring Enzo back. And it is something that has hurt me from the time that we lost Enzo. And again, I can't say or do anything for the owner to know that I truly am
sorry.
Thank you. Do any board members have any more questions?
Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of quick ones. If I understood an earlier question by Dr. Nosley about the dosage of T-Dex and for the purpose, the response was it was for the intubation, and then I'm hearing it was for the surgery in these latest statements. So there's some conflicting information. The other thing is, was there an approval for cremation? There's a dispute regarding the necropsy, but did you get an approval for cremation?
I just had an oral approval.
By?
The Mrs. Dunn. And that is noted in the record.
Thank you.
So I got to put in the record, where is the offer for necropsy and decline? Oral cremation noted in the record.
So there was.
For oral confirmation.
Yeah. When the records are sent, the communications with a particular program are not included as part of the record. And so in order to fulfill the board's requirements to include all of the communications with the owner as well, you will see on August 17th at 2:49 p.m., I had talked to Mrs. and a young man that came with her. And we had offered to cover the cremation, but we had also discussed that necropsy would be.
It's in the communication box, it looks like this.
Mr. Chairman, I have another quick question.
Just
to clarify, at that point, had the cremation been done?
Not at 2:49 p.m. on August 17th.
Okay. Thank you.
Have the communication notes written written typically at the time that they're happening, or is it something you write later in the day and?
It's like within the timeframe of being with the owner.
Because it does look like it's kind of written in past tense, like they.
Right, she had just left.
Any other board members have questions? None. This concludes the portion of the informal interview in which the board hears testimony. The board will now deliberate and decide what to do in this matter. Dr. Nosley, you are the lead.
Okay, thank you. First of all, I think we need to talk about the TT decks. That is what we commonly refer to as a cocktail. It's a combination of various medications. The discussions we've had up till now seem to focus on the dexmedetomidine, but that's only one of the drugs that's in there. Also, torbigesic butorphanol is in that cocktail, along with telazol, which is in itself a combination of two other drugs, provides this cocktail pretty profound sedation. They're all, in some fashion, respiratory depressants, or at least muscle relaxants, in the case of one of the drugs in telazol. So it's a combination of respiratory depressants in this cocktail. Regarding the dosage, I'm still a little confused about the dose being given for intubation. You would tend to be on the lower side, not even in the profound range. Just, in simple terms, just enough to intubate. Especially when you're considering a compromised patient. So the discussion, sure, on paper, the dose could be considered appropriate. But in this particular case, we don't generally dose pre-meds to kilograms. We dose pre-meds to our patient. And brachiocephalics, as the complainant showed us, there are many, many discussions in the literature regarding recommendations for appropriate pre-meds. And they're all, quite frankly, a little bit different. Some say don't use dexmedetomidine. Some say do in an appropriate dose. But what they all have in common is we need to do something to address the fact that we're dealing with a brachiocephalic. And in this case, it seems like the protocol was the same as it would be for any other patient. While there are some things addressed in the clinic setting regarding brachiocephalics, I'm having a hard time believing that that is sufficient. Dr. James mentioned the pre-oxygenation, that's often done. Low-dose pre-meds, in this cocktail, given in these doses, in layman's term, is a scary, scary thing. Different pre-meds can be used for your brachiocephalics, different protocols. Staff training, in this case, we know he had stenotic nares. He had stridor, so he very well may have had an elongated soft palate. We don't know what else was going on inside. That's why all the intubation issues, and we talk about smaller tubes. We talk about visualizing the lateral, the saccules in, during intubation, and all of these things are important in the brachiocephalic. They very often, in my experience, pretty much all of them, if they have the syndrome, they have a hypoplastic trachea. You've got to have small tubes to start with, and then go down from there. So I think that covers my concerns on it. The monitoring of the patient, just visual is not enough for any compromised patient. I mean, they have to be somebody hands-on, lifting the lip, looking at the color, noting not only are they breathing, but what's the depth of that respiration? Is that sufficient? Because of all these things that can happen, particularly with the brachiocephalic. So while they have very good setup for visually looking at the pre-medicated patients, I'm not sure that's enough. So regarding that, the communication issues, yeah, they're there. And we can discuss those and the necropsy and the cremation and that type of thing. But I think there's enough evidence there in this case to, I think, give us a pretty clear picture of what happened. So I would invite the other board members to weigh in on this.
Yeah, this is a tough one because we're not gonna really know, had the dose have been lowered, would it have made a difference, right? I mean, clearly this is the dose she consistently uses and doesn't typically have issues, but it's a much higher dose than what I would have expected in a brachiocephalic dog for the purpose of just intubating. I don't know, I feel like it's getting pretty standard to pre-oxygenate these little brachiocephalic dogs, but maybe not. So I don't wanna necessarily, can't really judge, like I would have done it, but I don't know that that's necessarily something like, take your cases, for example, would you, probably not. And, you know, so I think that can be a little bit challenging. As far as the monitoring, I agree with you. I would be very hesitant to give a brachiocephalic dog this dose and then put it in a kennel. Because even though it's right there in front of you, like, unless you're staring in the kennel like this, you can't really see anything. I mean, you can hear the sounds and you can hear if they're thrashing or if they fall over or that kind of stuff. But other than that, you can't really monitor it. And I think in some of these clinics, you know, that are, you know, routinely doing higher volume, that's one of the challenges. And I think with these brachiocephalic dogs, we need to look at things a little bit differently there. I think necropsies are a little bit frustrating sometimes because just the word necropsy is not something that most human patients would relate to. They would relate to an autopsy. And so sometimes I think what happens is we ask somebody if they want a necropsy, and in the emotion of what's going on, I don't even know that they know what that means or why you would do this or what's the benefit of it. And so I could totally see somebody saying, I don't want to do that, like I'm, and not really even know what they're agreeing or not agreeing to. So I think that that's probably what happened in this case. And, you know, so they move forward with the cremation, and well, now that the emotion comes down and we're starting to look into it and we're like, wait, what did happen with my dog? Well, now that it's gone, it's past the point that we can do that. So I think, is that a communication issue? Yeah, because we probably didn't explain it as well, but I think in veterinary medicine, we're used to using that terminology, and so I think that's probably part of what happened, but.
I think it's fair to be said two necropsies have a window of time that they can be done in. Once you freeze the patient, you lose a lot of evaluation purpose, you know? So it is a decision that has to be made pretty quickly.
Yeah, regardless of whether we'd cremated the dog or not.
Right. So that makes it really hard. I guess I haven't been in a high volume spay neuter situation, but is TT dex pretty common? Just because to me, when you're in an ER setting, Tiazol and dexmedetomidine together in a brachiocephalic sounds scary. So I don't know if it's just my experience, or since some of you, I think, have worked in shelter medicine and done higher, you know, volume. Do you see that combo pretty frequently? Again, as a pre-med too, I thought that was kind of fascinating. In this case, again, for brachycephalic and what he was there for beyond the neuter.
I mean, I see TTDs fairly commonly used. Would I say that it's fairly commonly used across all breeds or across high-risk dogs? That I don't know. You could probably answer that better from your shelter standards. But then again, too, you're dealing in a shelter. And I hate to say it, but that's going to be a slightly different expectation than an owner who's coming into a clinic. And I do feel like that's a different situation.
Very true. But I will say, like, our anesthetic incidences are very, very low.
Yeah,
so
they
it's kind of, you know, you come to a case like this and where there's an owner involved and something catastrophic happens in the shelter, like, I don't want to jinx us, but we really don't have anesthetic issues and we're not necessarily following the pre-oxygenation and all these things, so it is kind of interesting. I will say that TTDx is used in the high volume, in a couple of surrounding high volume spay neuter clinics for the public. But it does lend to the question, you know, when we start dealing with brachycephalics, high volume spay neuter clinics are meant for your not high risk patient, just your average patient. And just by definition, the brachycephalic is a high risk patient. And that does pose an issue though, because you also want to try to provide services for an owner who may or may not be able to get those services someplace else. So it does become a struggle being that veterinarian, but I think having those conversations, letting people know that a high volume clinic is safe, but they may not be able to have some of the same monitoring levels that you would find in a private practice, and therefore it lies the difference in the cost and that type of thing. So.
And while oftentimes I find myself going, I think high volume spay neuter clinics and doctors that do this day in, day out have lower complication rates because that's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
They're not seeing derm cases on the side. They, you know, they're only doing this and their speed is so much faster and their surgical recovery is faster. So a lot of times I say it's better, but if the anesthesia is not going to be able to be altered or monitored differently, then that's where I would go. I mean, that might not have been a patient that would have been best. But hindsight's 2022. I mean, I'm sure they've done a ton of brachycephalic dogs and not had an issue.
The public doesn't know that.
No.
They don't know what the difference between high volume, low cost is. They don't really understand what their service is being provided to them. So we're putting the onus on them to say, I've got a brachycephalic, so I'm not going to a spay clinic. There's no knowledge. All that they hear is cost, really. And there's nothing wrong with that. It serves a need. And most of them are very, very efficient. And this one seems to be very, very efficient. The problem is what has happened before, or in your case, what has happened many times in the past. Doesn't matter if you know you have a potential problem and it happens. So regarding spay clinics, you know, we could take that discussion as far as you want, but my problem with them is the owners don't really know. They don't really know that they're not getting an IV cap, that they're not going to, probably not going to have blood work. Most clinics, or a lot of clinics, it's mandatory. They just don't know that. So they present their patient, their pet to it, expecting a competent surgeon, which obviously we have a competent surgeon here. But that's a problem when we talk about the specifics of what can happen under these circumstances. It only has to happen once.
But it can happen at any clinic too.
I mean, it can.
It's happened in the best general practice. It's happened in referral practices. It can happen, right? So I use this, I probably open that can of worms on it being a higher volume, but
yeah.
I just want to verify. I do think it can happen anywhere.
Oh, I would agree, but I guess my point is in a specialty clinic or a surgical clinic, would they be doing these doses pre-med? That's my question. Yeah, it can happen.
I think I'm a combo here. I'm not 100% sure I can say the dose was completely wrong. I think it's higher than what I would have given, but I can't say it's out of line, right? It's still within that range. But I think it is wrong if you're not standing there monitoring that dog every second of the way. So it's like this combination of...
I can appreciate that, but now we're in a high volume situation, and now we're giving it what we're both agreeing is kind of a scary, dangerous cocktail. And we're in this situation.
But even your high volume spay neuter clinics, I mean, if Fragos cephalics are done first in the morning, or if they're done late in the day, I would argue first in the morning, right? Because you don't monitor it longer. But if they're done, your higher risk patients are done together, then maybe you do monitor them a little closer. And then you start on everything else the way you normally do it. But I think there's things that can be done, and I don't know if they do that or not. I didn't hear it, but. So I guess I would say my biggest concern is the combination of giving the higher level dose, knowing that we were causing profound sedation, and not having somebody there to adequately monitor to do something.
And was that higher level necessary for intubation? That's the question.
Yeah, it becomes like two deals. If you give the medication and you have a complication, and you're not adequately prepared to timely address that complication, then you have, you know, if you have an unexpected complication of the medication, but you couldn't act quick enough to mitigate that complication, then that's a two-pronged problem. Mm-hmm. It could be one in 100 or one in 1,000 or one in
whatever. Yeah.
And I would also agree that the medical records were confusing, and I think the doctor addressed that in that it didn't get put in correctly or whatever, but not evaluated isn't even that it just didn't get put in. It got put in as not evaluated, which makes me even more concerned, because if it had been blank, I could have said we forgot to put it in.
Don't set yourself up by having records that don't reflect what actually happened. That's true in all every case. Mm-hmm.
We've done a lot of discussing. Do we have any motion?
We do. We have a motion, and I would like to put forth a motion to the exact findings of the investigative committee. I think that's sufficient. ARS 3222-3211, gross negligence. For failure to be aware of the proper dose of TT dex, we could add for a compromised patient if we want, but to be administered to the dog, which led to the respiratory depression and eventual death, and not properly monitoring the dog prior to surgery. And then also ARS 3222-3218, as it relates to R311-502-H3, failure to perform an exam on the dog within 6 hours. It's kind of black and white, and it wasn't done, and maybe, I don't know, maybe if we would have done another exam at some point, I'm not sure, but I'm fine with that also.
I don't think the 6 hours is a big issue for me, because
it's not a big issue.
It met the spirit of the law.
Right.
Yeah.
But what I would say is, either not doing the exam or not ensuring the exam was documented. Because we don't know which happened. She might have done the exam and it didn't get documented, but either way, it's...
Okay.
I don't want to make that verbiage change.
Right.
Is there any reason to note the discrepancies in like CPR and the time those drugs were given and the time the TT dex was given followed all of that?
Records violation of some type?
Yeah, I mean, because we're talking about no exam, I mean, I'm guessing that's...
Mm-hmm.
That was a little interesting, because even just having an addendum, you know, of the actual time it was given. Because we don't know how long the dog wasn't examined for, or monitored for, you know? Like, when was the TT dex even given? That morning?
Well, maybe that becomes a side concern, which is something's wrong with the system if it's
the number, the time's going backwards.
Well, and I don't know if it's being captured by the system or if somebody's manually typing it in and somebody manually typed in a very wrong time, but yeah.
Yeah, and I definitely think that that's something that, whether it's a letter of concern or just a notation, that I'm concerned about their medical records in general.
Sure, yeah, just something in there just so that that's notated that, you know, again, if it's human entry, right, then paying attention to that fact. If it's the software, figuring out where the glitch is there, because sometimes the software is based off the time on the computer, right? If somebody messed with the time on the computer, then, you know, those are like little things that can be a big deal, especially in this case where that clearly was a problem for the pet owner, that somebody's not telling the truth, right? And I need to get to the bottom of this, and maybe if that could have been addressed,
it wouldn't have been an issue.
Yeah. Do you think it rises to the level of violation or a letter of concern?
That's a hard thing, because if how long was that TTDX given before, you know, things mm-hmm. happened? And
a lot of questions.
Because yeah. Did that affect the outcome?
We don't have okay. the information to know.
I mean, yeah. I would say.
But again, it's just like something somewhere where we can document it somewhere. That way it does, it's important somewhere, at least from the practice level, to have a stopgap. You know, again, yeah. is it somebody to take it in? Is it?
You could do it as part of, because we already have the one for not doing the exam, or at least ensuring that the exam was documented, in addition to ensuring that all timestamps and entries into the medical record are accurate.
Okay.
Well, again, it's about administering medications, and we're supposed to be documenting, you know, the time that's given, and, mm-hmm. and you know, those details.
Can
so.
I amend that? Yeah.
Would you add a rule? Because it wouldn't necessarily make that same H3, would it?
Is that, well, I was going to say, is that because the H3 is not doing the exam?
Right. Would we have to do a separate one with a different one?
Well, or did we just pick one or the other and say the exam wasn't done? Or do we say we believe she did an exam based on she did yeah. note that there were stenotic well, mirrors in order to add that to the estimate?
So what about the issue, other issues?
Then we
issues
could change that to medical records.
Yeah. What about the other issues other than the exam, the issues in the medical records.
Yeah.
Is that, to so do something you, about that?
Yeah, but is that a premise thing? Is she the premise holder? Because you do wonder if it's a software thing, because if you look, the information on the CPR is timestamped at 7:33 a.m. So mm-hmm. obviously that's not something that you generally put in as the doctor. That's what the computer generates. So that wouldn't be necessarily on her per se unless she's the premise holder, right?
But it is on her to make sure her record.
Make sure it's her patient.
Right, but how do you, but some of those you can't, right. If it's a timestamp, you're not likely able to alter it.
I think I would have documented that in the record at the time. If this is a computer problem, mm-hmm. these times are incorrect.
I think, from listening to the testimony, I believe an exam was done. I believe that's how she could describe the dog's breathing. She could describe the stenotic mirror. She could describe yeah. enough that makes me go, she did an exam. So I think my violation would really be more on medical records and documentation of proper okay. medical records mm-hmm. rather than lack of exam. Okay. And then you can tie in the accuracy and the time stamping and all of that.
Right. Makes sense?
Yes.
So it would not be H3.
Yeah, it'd be a different
and
rule.
And actually, that's not the right one anyway. It's H2. It refers to the 6 hours.
Yeah. It would have been
H2. Maybe not law, Tracy, we need
help.
Yeah. Could be the statute.
Yeah, the statute, not a rule.
I'm going to defer to you guys who have gone through this one before.
I don't even have my
Go ahead, Tracy, help us out.
It's 22.
Well, it's 21, if it's for medical record keeping errors, 32, 22, 32, 21. And then if you want to point to a rule, it's generally 511-502 under L. A more generalized.
Yeah, I think it's more generalized than the specifics, because it's like the exam that was said not evaluated when we believed that the evaluation was done, it was just not properly documented, but I don't know that you want to go through each one individually, it's more just generally the medical record.
Be 22, 32, 21.
Asking if maybe 21, just overall failure to maintain adequate medical record keeping and just cite what your concerns are, but not actually pointing to a rule. So I was asking Mark if that would still be appropriate.
Okay. And you said yes?
Well, you generally, when you find a record violation associated with something in 502, that's not to say that you couldn't, and we can just see how this moves forward.
I mean, we could definitely do L4 for the lack of documentation of the exam.
And then
and then maybe just call out the inconsistencies in timing and when things were performed. Leave that kind of generic, but at least call out L4 for the exam. So you want to amend yours to that?
Yeah. Restate that for me, please.
So instead of ARS 32, 22, 32, 18, it would be 21?
32, 21.
As it relates to
L4,
L4.
For lack of the examination. And also included in there is the inconsistencies
and timing.
The timing and the inconsistency. Happened.
Yeah. Time locations.
Yeah. Okay. So moved.
Second. Yeah, who needs a second?
And a second. Any further discussion?
And that goes in addition to the other one that you
Right.
So we have two violations.
Yeah.
Any other discussion? Then let's do a roll call.
Dr. Byrne?
Aye.
Ms. Crager?
Aye.
Ms. Frost?
Aye.
Dr. James?
Aye.
Mr. Lohi?
Aye.
Dr. Nosley?
Aye.
Ms. Solomon?
Aye.
Dr. Thompson?
Aye.
Motion passes.
The board has voted to find two violations. At next month's meeting, the board will consider adopting proposed findings of facts and conclusions of law, and after doing so, will then discuss and adopt disciplinary action. If you have any questions, please call the board's executive director, Victoria Whitmore, at the board's office. And this concludes the informal interview for this case. Thank you all for participating.